This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
I'm looking for the best place to launch a mission to the ISS.
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here are your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. I'm your host, Chuck Tomasi, and notably absent this time is my wonderful co-host, Craig Stepp. How are you, Craig? Have I got a real treat for you today? I've got an interview with game designer Richard Garriott, a.k.a. Lord British. He's probably best known for his Ultima series of games and his latest, Tabula Rasa. He's also done lots of other things like exploring the RMS Titanic, Magician, and Magic Collector. Recently, I was informed that Richard was headed for the International Space Station. His mission has a strange tie to his video games, so I had to call him up and find out what he's up to.
Hello, Chuck.
Hello, Richard. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much.
You don't sound British. I'm just kidding.
yeah, exactly. You know the story about that, don't you?
Apparently, yeah. When you got to Texas and somebody thought you spoke with a British accent?
Yep. Exactly. Well, that's because I grew up in Houston, or NASA more particularly, which was a manufactured community from people all over the world. So I don't really have a Texas accent either. And so compared to real Texans, people with a true Texas accent, my accent sounded foreign. So they guessed it was British. And as it turns out, I was born in England, so it stuck. Even though obviously I don't have much of a British accent. Although I do have my application for United Kingdom passport here in my hand. So I am going to be applying for a British passport because I'm doing some work with the British National Space Center while I'm in space. And I thought it's about time that I made my dual citizenship a little more official.
Well, let's take a step back. Where does the story of Richard start?
Well, let's see. I was actually born, strangely, in Cambridge, England. And I say strangely just because both my parents are American and I've grown up really in America. But for 1 year, while my father was a professor at Stanford University, he took a year's leave of absence, or a sabbatical, I really should say, to go to Cambridge University and work at a laboratory there. And I was born just a few months before my parents came back. And so by virtue of being born in England, that's where my Lord British nom de plume that I often use in gaming came from.
Well, I got to tell you that both Craig and I, Craig was unable to make it for this call, but was really looking forward to, so I'll proxy his questions in there. We are both big Ultima fans and have enjoyed as much as we could. It was one of those games that sucked me in. It was probably the first game I remember in the 80s that just was, I was totally immersed.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. And of course, having worked on them, I'm well aware of how much of a lifestyle it can become if you're not careful. These big, not just Ultima, but other large scale fantasy role-playing games can be pretty overwhelming, but fun.
Some people don't understand the whole world of Warcraft and getting involved with a game like that for days and weeks on end.
That's right.
I spent many weeks making maps of the various continents in the world of Ultima 1, and it was that was the fun of it. I mean, many hours in the dungeons.
Exactly. Well, me too.
Where did that idea come from?
An interesting thing happened to me in high school. My freshman year in high school, I had three events occur to me effectively simultaneously. One was my sister-in-law actually provided me my first copy of The Lord of the Rings, which was, you know, so fantasy works of fiction were new to me at that moment. And so I was, of course, incredibly impressed by The Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
Second is I was exposed to computers for the first time. In fact, the school I was going to had teletype that was connected with an acoustic modem to an offsite computer.
Oh, yeah.
But suddenly I had access to computers. And even though the school didn't really teach anything about those computers, I quickly became took up the computer in a self-study way, and so that kind of came in the mix. And then also, that's right about when Dungeons & Dragons was first published, and so I was one of the first early adopters of Dungeons & Dragons on paper. And if you combine those three things all together, you get the Ultima series, effectively. So that's really what gave me my start.
What did you use to develop the original Ultima games? I mean, there weren't fourth generation compilers and things back then. Was it assembly? Did you do it hardcore like that?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So the back in those days, the very first Ultima was actually written in BASIC with a little bit of assembly language. And after that, I began to write them entirely in assembly language. And what's important to note about that era in time is not only were there not particularly powerful compilers, but there were also no real art tools or sound tools or tools of any kind. And so literally to put a piece of graphics up on the screen, like, say, grass or water or a mountain, I actually had to first sit down and plot it out on graph paper. Then I had to convert the dots on graph paper into hexadecimal, or first into binary, because certain bits were used in special ways.
Mm-hmm.
Then convert the binary into hexadecimal, then convert the hexadecimal into type that into the machine. And then I had to write programs to move that binary image around in memory to try to put it on the screen. And so if what showed up on screen didn't look like what I hoped it looked like, you had to debate whether, was it because I drew it wrong on graph paper, or I calculated it wrong in binary, or I converted it wrong to hex, or I typed it in wrong, or my art program didn't work. And so to debug, any part of that was extraordinarily difficult. But I had to write all of my own tools from truly scratch.
I found out we also have something else in common. I was reading through one of your biographies somewhere. We've both worked at a computer land store in the 80s. What did you do there?
Wow. Yeah, that's fantastic. That's a true rarity. In fact, I think you're the only other person I've talked to other than my mates at the original store I was working at.
I have one of my business cards still.
Yeah, as do I, as a matter of fact. And I was a salesperson. And as you probably remember back in the 80s, we ostensibly were selling people computers to do things like balance their checkbook or keep their recipe files on.
Yeah.
And these machines, cost you a few thousand dollars a piece even then for these, 64K Apple IIs and the Commodores, et cetera. So, the power of the machines were pretty minimal. And but it was at that computer land store is actually when I began to, sit in the back after hours and work on those first few Ultimas. And it was the owner of the computer land store, a guy named John Mayer, who saw me and my game in the back of the store and looked at the pegboard wall full of Ziploc baggies of games that we were selling, and looked at the game I had on the screen. And he was the one that said, Richard, the game you've written that I see right here is better than all the games we have there on the wall. You should publish it. And I went out and spent what I thought was a huge amount of money, $200, which was all the money I had in the world, and bought Ziploc baggies and Xerox cover sheets, and started manufacturing them right there on the Apple II at the store and hanging them on pegboard at that one Computerland store. And it was one of those first about dozen copies that sold that first week that found its way to California to a national distributor who called me up and said, hey, we'd like to distribute your game nationally. They put it in a bigger Ziploc bag. They raised the price by 2.5 times. They put a color Xerox sheet in the front. And they sold about 30,000 copies of what was the Ultima predecessor called a Calibeth. And my royalties were $5 a unit. So if you do that math, 30,000 units, $5 a piece, that's $150,000 that I made as a high school senior for what really took me, about 6 or 7 weeks of after school time. And so obviously that rate of return was so phenomenal that it was obvious that I should, do this again, but intending it for publication. And that's what really began the first Ultima, right there at the computer.
I'm familiar with the Ultima for the Apple II, but it was also available on the Commodore.
That's right.
And you know, several other platforms.
Yeah, at peak, it was Apple II, Commodore 64, Amiga, Commodore Amiga, Atari, Atari ST, the Atari 800, the Atari 1600, the Macintosh, and and the IBM, the original IBM PC. So that was, eight or so formats all at the same time at peak.
Did you have to rewrite it entirely on each platform, or how much was portable?
The machines were not particularly compatible. It was a fair bit of manual labor to recompile it. I mean, even the CPUs were different, and since they weren't written in things like C or any of these other advanced languages back in those days, it was mostly direct assembly. And so, to a large degree, somebody had to go rewrite it from scratch. I mean, a lot of the art was at least convertible, but fundamentally it was rewritten.
That's hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
This is David Levy, amateur astronomer, lover of the night sky, and comet discoverer. You are listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Your latest game.
Tabula Rasa.
I was going to say that, but didn't want to quite. It sounded more African or something.
Exactly. Since it's a Latin term, it's often mispronounced, as you were guessing that it might be. And that's a Latin term for blank slate, which was originally the working title of the game, just because it was not Ultima. It was starting over again from scratch. And so that's why we had a working title of Tabula Rasa. But it eventually escaped us and got into the public nomenclature, so to speak. So since the game fictionally also begins with the devastation of the Earth and the survivors, you know, starting fresh, into the fighting on the void to try to rebuild a civilization while being threatened by these evil aliens, we still thought Tabula Rasa had appropriate logic, so to speak, for the game. And so it became the final name of the game, too.
Tell us a little bit about that game.
So while Ultimas, as you are at least familiar, are medieval fantasy massively, the last Ultima, massively multiplayer fantasy role-playing game, Tabula Rasa is set in the near future. And so instead of, running around with swords and tights, you instead get, more sci-fi futuristic weapons and equipment, and you play... you battle across a number of planets that you get to explore, visiting both friendly alien cultures as well as hostile alien cultures, while you try to figure out what went wrong on Earth and how to survive and rebuild society.
Quite different. Enough about the games. Now you're going into space. The first offspring of an American astronaut to go into space. What's this mission all about, Richard?
That's right. Well, and as you kind of alluded to there, I'll be joining in space Sergei Volkov, the first second-generation Russian, and we return from space together. So when we come to the ground, it will usher in the, what I'll call the global second generation of travelers in space. I think every kid grows up at least believing for at least some window of time in their youth that they want to grow up, if not to be specifically an astronaut, at least to have the chance to fly into space. And I was no different than everybody else.
Absolutely.
Except since I grew up at, right across the street from NASA, not only was my father an astronaut, but literally my right hand and left hand next door neighbors were astronauts. My neighborhood was filled with astronauts, and those people who weren't astronauts were all NASA engineers and scientists involved in putting people in space. So I grew up believing everybody went to space because everybody I knew did go to space. and there was this pivotal moment that occurred one time when I was at NASA getting a medical checkup, when one of the optometrists turned to me and noticed that I had poor eyesight and was prescribing me glasses and said, "Hey Richard, I'm really sorry, but your poor eyesight will prevent you from being selected as an astronaut." And suddenly I was being told that, "Sorry, Richard, you're not going to be in the club. That everyone else you know is in, you're now out."
Oh, how devastating.
Yeah, and so I was devastated for a couple of days. However, I think what it did is, as opposed to giving up on it, which I think any sane person might have done, instead for me, it made me kind of double down and say, if I can't go as a government astronaut, I'll have to figure out a way to go privately. And ever since then, even though my vocation has always been in computer games, my personal investing has always been toward the privatization of space. And so even though I'm only just now flying, as you may know, I'm one of the major shareholders of Space Ventures, the company that flies people to space. Mm-hmm. Plus, recently, we recently merged the companies back together, but there was a company called Zero G Corp that does Zero G Parabolas. I'm the big supporter and on the board of the XPRIZE and have been since the very beginning. And I've invested in a number of other private space ventures down through the decades, all with the goal in mind of letting private citizens, including myself, get to space.
Fantastic. Your dad isn't going with you on this mission?
Well, he's not going with me, but he will be here. In fact, he's been my chief scientist, helped me put my mission together. Because, something that we have as a kind of a family trait that I picked up from him, and I have a suspicion he got from his father, is that, one of the things that we do as a habit, and I guess you would call a belief, is that, if you have the opportunity to reach some of these rare and valuable places on the surface of the Earth, be that the deep sea floor or Antarctica or the Amazon or, the deep remote parts of Africa, all of which I've also done, we have a sense of responsibility, if not, feel that it in fact adds a lot of meaning and interest into the activity to go there, not just to vacation, but go there to do real scientific work that is valuable for both pure science but also to look for value that you can bring back in a sense of building businesses as well. And so, for example, with some of the extremophile bacteria that we've discovered around deep ocean hydrothermal vents, mm-hmm. Which are these critters that live at high temperature and in toxic conditions, or what we would consider toxic conditions, we've extracted novel proteins and created a number of novel biological products that we sell. And some of those proteins I'm actually taking with me up into space to crystallize where we can really increase the value of those structures we've discovered at hydrothermal vents. And similarly, I'm taking into space with me other proteins at the behest of pharmaceutical companies, because it turns out this is the microgravity environment is very valuable to pharmaceutical companies, but they rarely have access to someone who's capable and willing to fly experiments into space. And you might think that it would be obvious that NASA or Russia would be all over that, but they, for the last 10 years, have been really doing, pretty much tightly focused on construction of the space station. And now they're pretty much moving their focus to landing somebody on the moon and Mars again. And so, therefore, there's a real gap, a real opportunity for private space investment to do scientific and commercial work on orbit that provides value. So I'm actually offsetting a good chunk of my flight with commercial activity. And I believe that if I get to fly again, which I hope I do, it will be because I have proven that I can do business in space that is valuable enough to cover the cost of entry to space.
What sort of preparation is involved with space travel? I mean, tell the listener where you are at the moment, by the way.
Well, I'm in a little town called Star City in Russia, and just outside the gates of the Gagarin Cosmonaut Training Center, where I spend all day, every day training, and have been pretty much full-time since January.
Wow.
And when I first was coming here in January, I thought, gee, they're not going to trust me with flying the spacecraft. So why is it I need 9 months of training pre-flight?
Mm-hmm.
But pretty quickly I learned, whoops, hey, 9 months is not much time to master all the skills I really need to master to be able to even operate for a week on the space station and be able to accomplish all the tasks I want to accomplish, as well as just operate safely. Every surface of the International Space Station, since it's in microgravity, the floor and the ceilings and the walls are all pretty much the same, and they're all covered with critical equipment. And whether that's communication equipment, whether that is a variety of life support equipment, including oxygen regeneration, carbon dioxide scrubbing, the moisture in the air is condensed out on the air conditioners and squeegeed into containers, which is then recycled into drinking water. So you literally drink your sweat after a few days of recycling.
Hmm.
The complex operations of the zero-G toilet, what to do in case of depressurization or fire or toxic atmospheres, just living, or even you know, a very simple thing that you have to learn about is, you know, for example, going to sleep is potentially hazardous in ways you might not expect. For example, you know, when I sleep here in when anybody here on the earth sleeps in their bed, when you exhale the carbon dioxide heavy air, it's also warm. And since it's warm, it tends to rise and go away from in front of your face, and new fresh air with higher oxygen content comes in behind it. So you breathe, when you breathe in more oxygen. Well, in space, there's no up. And so if you sit in one of the cabins and you just sit there and breathe in and out and breathe in and out, you will slowly consume all of the oxygen in the air pocket that's right in front of your face.
Oh, my goodness.
And you would quickly have problems if you didn't move or provide circulation with a fan. And so the way on the space station, they do that by providing circulation with fans all over the place. There's lots and lots of fans, lots and lots of hoses of tubes running all over the place. But for example, if I go to a dead end, like in the airlock, which is a place that I'm debating on camping out as a, there's actually only two bedrooms and there's six of us, actually three bedrooms and six of us on board. So three of us have to camp out in the hallway, so to speak. and one of the places I was going to camp out is the airlock, but the airlock also is a dead end and therefore, you know, has potentially more circulation trouble. And so I have to be very careful to make sure I go to sleep in a place that has good ventilation or you might not wake up.
That's something that I've never thought about. I mean, there are just so many aspects that you have to prepare for. The biological, the technological.
You know, fortunately, if you look at the total history of space travel, it's you know, compared to automobiles or airplanes, it's actually got a pretty darn good safety track record, in spite of the fact that the energies involved, and you know, and so therefore the you know, the forces working at odds against each other are you know, much worse, you might say, or much more stressful than other forms of transport. Yet still, it's actually been pretty safe, and especially the Soyuz launch vehicle has you know, a Soyuz number one had a fatality. However, every Soyuz since then has been a success. And so that's a 40-year track record of perfect safety. And so, you know, it doesn't get much better than that from a safety standpoint. And that's one of the reasons I'm particularly excited to be flying on the Soyuz.
Of course, safety does have a factor when you do something like this.
Yeah.
This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics, author of the new book, Physics of the Impossible. Yet, I can't even figure out Technorama.
What have you found to be the most interesting aspects of preparing?
Wow, there's really many, but I would say you know, the unexpected discoveries, like going to sleep, like that story I just told you about going to sleep,
mm-hmm.
Have definitely been what I'll call highest on the list. And it's often fairly simple things, like of course, you know, it's there's some things that you might obviously expect to be particularly exciting, like doing zero G parabolas is always fun to get a chance to float around on the inside of a airplane that's falling out of the sky.
That does look fun.
And similarly, you know, the day they delivered my spacesuit that I got to try on and go in a vacuum chamber with is, you know, always, it's always a good day when you, as a lot of the other astronauts here say, you know, it's always a good day when you get to wear your spacesuit. So that's definitely true too. But I've enjoyed the kind of small little deviations from normal reality that occur. Like for example, just last week, I had to do a training session in a vacuum chamber without my spacesuit, where they took the atmospheric pressure down to about 1/4 atmosphere, which is about 10,000 meters in altitude.
Wow.
And they did provide me oxygen so I wouldn't pass out.
Well, that was thoughtful.
Yeah, otherwise I'm exposed to the lower pressure. So I had to pre-breathe in oxygen to get the nitrogen out of my body so I wouldn't get the bends. And then when we got up to 10,000 meters, which is a fair bit higher even than Mount Everest in effective altitude.
That's about where airlines cruise.
Yeah, exactly. But I noticed a really interesting side effect, which was that, and this might be a little difficult to follow. If you imagine when you make a clicking sound with your tongue on the roof of your mouth,
yeah,
you know, that kind of sound, that's made by making a little vacuum between your tongue and the roof of your mouth. Well, when you're at 10,000 meters and there's almost a vacuum on the outside of your body, when you try to make a sound, instead of making a sound, you actually end up just open. You can start with no air gap in your mouth, and then open your mouth with your lips closed to its full capacity with just a vacuum on the inside, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. In other words, since there's no outside air pressure, your body physiology changes, if you know what I mean, in very interesting ways. You can't snap your fingers. You can't make a snap sound because there's not enough air to transmit that sound very well. And so anyway, just being in the vacuum chamber at 10,000 meters was quite an interesting experience.
Craig thought that the seat molding looked fascinating too.
Yes, and with the seat molding, I got to tell you, one thing you cannot be is claustrophobic. Unfortunately, I'm not. I'm a big caver and things too. I can't remember which exact pictures are up online. I think there's a pretty good images of it. But you know, not only do they put you, you know, the seated position in a Soyuz is already fairly tight in the sense of your heels are right by your butt, and you're curled up a little bit in the fetal position. Of, you know, even other than that, and to make this mold of your body, not only they put you in that position, but then they have two or three husky people push you in the bottom of this mold, while three or four other people bring by, you know, big 5-gallon buckets full of plaster of Paris and pour it over your whole body. And they hold you at the bottom of this, so you don't float up out of it, you know, while it sets around your body. And not only you're in this little aluminum, you know, tunnel, there's people crowded all over you where you can't really see out, and they're pushing you on the bottom and burying you in something that is becoming solid, you know, as you sit inside of it. And so it's, you know, I just sit there and think about it, you know, it's going like, wow, you know, this could go badly if, you know, and of course it doesn't, of course, but then to get you out, you have to bring a big, heavy industrial crane and come winch you and suck you out of the, you know, semi-solid plaster of Paris. It's a very interesting procedure.
I don't know that too many people could do that.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's interesting that psychologically, I suppose there's definitely a hurdle of you really have to be a thrill seeker, so to speak, to want to. However, I would not actually describe any of the training I've gone through as necessarily any harder than things people do who, you know, are generally thrill-seeking types in other ways. For example, you know, I've gone through lots of classes and examinations, but it's definitely no harder than you know, your normal courses at college. I go through physical training, but it's definitely not harder than I go through at the local boxing gym that I work out at. You know, I'm doing these, what you might consider extreme sports in the, you know, with some of these centrifuges or zero-G parabolas. But all of those things are things that really the general public can handle, you know, pretty well. It's just, you just have to be, you know, what I'll call mentally calm and prepared for it. And I would say really the most important trait, if I was going to describe, you know, a mental trait that would be important for someone who wanted to undertake this, would just be to remain calm under adverse conditions. And that's something I'd learned even as far back as when I used to do a lot of rock climbing and rappelling and such, mm-hmm. which is, you know, when an emergency occurs, which I've been in cases where, you know, things have not gone as planned while rock climbing and rappelling. But as long as everybody, you know, stays calm and holds their position and, you know, evaluates, you know, how to work your way out of it, you know, you can generally manage those situations. And the same thing's true for space travel. These systems are planned with many, many layers of backup. And everyone is trained, including myself. We go through, you know, one of the biggest chunks of training I go into is what to do in what's described as off-nominal situations, which happen in every flight. Even my, go back to my dad's flights, that all every flight has something that, more than one thing that goes wrong during that flight. But there's, you know, there's just a sequence of events of what do you do when this fails or if this fails. And that's really what the majority of the training is you go through every possible failure condition. So when the alarms go off, which they will, just relax, look at the alarm, see what it is, and do the step you've been trained to do. And as long as everyone does that, there's a very high probability that everything will be safe.
Hi, this is Dean Hagel from The X-Files, and you're listening to Technorama with Chuck and Craig.
I want to believe.
Now, I was steered towards you by author Tracy Hickman,
yes,
who mentioned Operation Immortality.
Exactly.
Tell me what that's what's going on there.
It's related to the game, to my game Tabula Rasa, in that, as you know, fictionally for that game, I described how it it begins with the devastation of the Earth and how humanity spreads into the galaxy, trying to both survive and also fight against the you know, the oppressive aliens who came and destroyed the Earth in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And so, fictionally, we thought, well, gee, if you know, if we're at all worried about potential devastations to the surface of the Earth in the future, you know, maybe we should create effectively a time capsule to survive that devastation of the Earth. And while that began fictionally, I actually think that there's a metaphor for reality, that for the real world we live in, that goes beyond just the game. For example, interestingly, I had the great joy about a year ago, a little about a year and a half ago, of doing some zero-G parabolas with Stephen Hawking. And in fact, I'm taking the cover of Lucy and Stephen Hawking's book, George's Secret Key to the Universe, with me to space. And so since I'm taking that cover up, they invited me over to their house last month for tea.
Oh, how neat.
Which actually was really cool. It turns out they live in Cambridge, only about 6 blocks from the house I was born in Cambridge. So I went and visited the Earth house while I was over there. And one of the things that Stephen has often espoused about the importance of humans in space, which I personally am also a believer of, is that you know, it's not a question of whether life on Earth will be threatened, because we know that it will be.
Yep.
We know that life on Earth, in fact, will be destroyed. It's only a question of whether it will be soon or a long time from now, and whether it's you know, the sun's death in some millions of years or billions of years, or a meteor in some you know, more random, probably closer time, or something of humanity's doing. You know, it will occur. And so what we've done with Operation Immortality is we've decided to let every, you know, not just players of Tabula Rasa, although we're taking all of the data for everyone who has ever played Tabula Rasa will be on the Immortality Drive. But we're also letting people vote on what the greatest accomplishments of humanity have been over time. And we are basically have selected at random some players to be able to contribute their DNA that we're digitizing and putting that on the Immortality Drive. And we've been contacting a variety of celebrities. And when I mean celebrities, I don't mean in the sense of movie stars as much as people of social and scientific significance to participate and have their genetic information also stored on the Immortality Drive, which I will be taking to space, storing on the space station permanently, just in case, for whether it's calamities that naturally befall the Earth,
mm-hmm,
humanity's own calamities that befall the Earth, or you never know, Tabula Rasa's prediction of the future calamity befalls the Earth. any of those occur, and we will have preserved some of the important parts of humanity on the space station.
Hey, think we can get an episode of Technorama on that hard drive somewhere?
You know, it's entirely possible. We'll see. Just compress it down and send it over.
I'll have a link to you on for this interview right away.
Excellent.
I could go on for a long time. There are so many questions from listeners and from my co-host. But the one that stands out here that strikes me is when you're up there in space, looking out the window at Earth, the moon, and all the stars, what do you think your thoughts and hopes would be?
You know, that's a very interesting question and somewhat difficult to answer. And in that, you know, of course, having never been there yet, the only way I can really speculate is by thinking about or talking with others who have gone before and what do they, you know, what have their impressions been. And it's fairly universal that astronauts describe how one of their greatest joys about being in orbit, well, you know, even beyond the feeling of microgravity, is the ability to look back at the Earth and see the Earth from, you know, 250 miles up, which is, while extraordinarily high, is again surprisingly close to the Earth compared to what most people probably think. Most people probably think, you know, if you use a classroom globe that's about a foot in diameter, most people think, you know, a spaceship, you know, orbits the Earth some distance away from that globe. But as you may know, 250 miles up on a one foot diameter globe is only about the width of a nickel, and yeah. so or maybe a couple of nickels. So you are really just skimming above the atmosphere barely as you go around here at 17,210 miles an hour. But that is high enough to where not only can you see, the curvature of the Earth in all directions from your from that spot or vantage point in space, but additionally. You know, you see it without any of the artificial boundaries between people. So you know, there's no boundaries between countries. Humanity's impact, however, is now big enough to be seen. You know, not only can you see easily, you know, the sprawl of cities as they grow into the surrounding Earth. Things like deforestation is detectable from space, as well as some, you know, what I'll call more the climate impacts. Mm-hmm. You know, the things like river deltas or recession of glaciers, etc. And so. Most astronauts come back saying how they really change their vantage point about their view of the Earth and humanity's place in on Earth. But you know, you really have to ask me when I get back to know for sure.
We'll have to follow up. When is the mission, by the way?
October 12th is the launch date, and it's set for basically midday here, which I happen to know in Austin, Texas, will be 2 a.m. So you can calculate back and forth from Austin, Texas, 2 a.m. on October 12th, and you can adjust from there. And October 12th is Columbus Day, which is a good day to fly, I think.
That's appropriate. And how long will you be up there?
I'll be up for 10 days, 2 days in the Soyuz before docking, 8 days docked. And then once you undock, you're actually back on the ground within just a few hours. And once I'm on the ground, it's only about 2 hours till I'm back in this room. So the return trip is really fast.
Wow.
The outbound route is slow.
Sounds like air travel.
Yeah, exactly.
Like renting a car. It takes forever to get through that line and get the vehicle. Once you return it, you're done and out.
Exactly right.
A little
exactly
different right. scale, though.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Richard, like I said, we could go on and on, you know, Titanic and deep sea and space and more games. I know you're a very busy person and I appreciate your time. Before you go, where can the listener find out more about you and what you're up to?
Yes. Well, if you go check out richardinspace.com, all one word, richardinspace.com, you'll see my blogs that I've been putting up about the training and activities here. And I'm sure once we get close to flight, you know, all the links for where to watch it on webcasts and things, since it'll be broadcast on NASA Select webcasts. So you'll be able to check it there, too.
Thank you very much, Richard. This has been a real treat. Highlight of my month. And it's been a busy month.
Yeah, excellent. But no, it's been a real pleasure for me too.
Thank you. Take care and safe travels. We'll talk to you again.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this special interview with Richard Garriott, a.k.a. Lord British. Perhaps we can talk to him later this year after his mission is over and find out what he's come up with. If you'd like to get in touch with us, call the Technorama listener line at 206-222-CHAT. That's 206-222-2428. We'd love to hear from you. You can also drop us an email at technorama@chuckchat.com. There are plenty of other ways to show your support, like leaving a tip in the tip jar. Just look for the PayPal links on the chuckchat.com/technorama site. How about a review in the iTunes Music Store? That doesn't cost anything. Or add us as a favorite on Podcast Pickle? Yeah, that's free too. We appreciate it even if you just tell a friend that you heard this cool interview with one of tech's greatest people and point them to the site. I want to extend a special thanks to Mad Marv, who keeps our website full of fresh and bizarre content. If you're listening to this show through the website, why not subscribe for free? You'll get each show downloaded to you automatically as it's available. Did I mention it's free? If you've got questions, look for the question mark on the main page at chuckchat.com to learn more. This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech. You can find out more at friendsintech.com. We're also affiliated with Farpoint Media and a whole bunch of audio goodness over at farpointmedia.net. That's all for this time. Stay digital and a binary high five. 101.
Oh, shut up, you mouth!